The following is a lecture by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
The mitzvah is that the Kohanim have an obligation that when they carry the Aron Kodesh, right, the what's called the Holy Ark, when they carry the Ark, so then they are supposed to carry it on their shoulders. The Ark has to be carried on the shoulders of the Kohanim. Now, if you remember, we did one of the mitzvahs earlier. I don't remember the number. It's the mitzvah of removing, not the prohibition of removing the poles from the Ark. Remember that mitzvah? The prohibition, the Ark had poles, and there's prohibition to remove the poles from the Ark, right? Remember what the idea was behind that mitzvah? You can't remove the poles from the Ark. That's supposed to symbolize that. What do the poles do? The poles are the support system for the Ark. That means, right, the pillars of Torah, the support for Torah, should never cease, right? One must never stop to withdraw their support of Torah. The support of Torah does not have to be only financial support, though it helps, right? But it's not the only type of support. In our day and age, support of Torah is also moral support. There are plenty of people who are learning Torah who have their material needs, but they haven't got their families behind them, right? And that sometimes is just as difficult as not having the financial means. Now, this Ark, before we understand why you have to carry it on your shoulder, let's understand what the Ark was. The Ark, first of all, do you know the dimensions of the Ark, how big it was? And it put everything you saw in the movies, everything you saw in Raiders, you know, put that away. I never even saw Raiders, you tell you the movie by heart. Right? Put everything out of your, whatever you saw, put it out of your mind completely. Right? What were the dimensions of the Ark? So in the Torah, the dimensions were 2.5 amos long. The Ark was 2.5 amos long by 1.5 amos wide and 1.5 amos high. Now what was contained? What is the start of this shear is the signal for them to begin drilling.
It doesn't start until 5:30.
The dimensions were 2.5 long by 1.5 wide by 1.5 high. Now when you look through, 2.5 amos by 1.5 amos, by an amma is about an amma is literally from here to here, right? Which in is somewhere between 16 and, so yeah, it's pretty small. By somewhere between 16 and 22 inches long, depending on the estimation of what the amma is, right? So 2.5 of the Ark was not this massive structure. The Ark was, you know, about yi long, right? Yi wide, right? Yi high. Now it also had a cover on it, and it was coated. It was made of three boxes. There was an outside box which was made of gold. There's an inside box made of gold. And there's a middle box. There was one box inside another. There was a middle box made of wood.
This is the Ark of the Covenant?
This is the Ark of the Covenant. This is the Aron HaBris, yeah. That's the whole Ark. It was the shape of a square box. Square box. They had the tablets inside, right? The luchos were inside the Ark. It was the square shape of a square box, and the dimensions were 2.5. By 1.5 by 1.5.
So it's just the tablets in there. Nothing.
The tablets are in there according to some. There are different opinions. What else is in there? The whole tablets are in there. The broken tablets are in there. According to some, there's a written Torah scroll. A written Torah scroll is in there. And there's an opinion that the manna came down and they put away a portion of the manna for eternity. Right, and there's according to some that portion of the manna is in the Ark also. Right? Now, what's the idea? Why would they put the manna in the Ark? Why do you think they put the manna in the Ark?
So no one can get to it.
If they could put the manna, they didn't have to stop the people. They could put the manna in the altar also, and no one would get to it because no one's allowed in there. What? It's a holy thing, but so why? In the Beis HaMikdash, remember, the Beis HaMikdash is divided up into three areas, right? You've got the area where the sacrifices are brought. You've got beyond that is what's called the area called the Holy, right? Which is where the menorah was, and the table with the showbread was there, and the small altar where they burnt the incense. And then beyond there, in the small compartment, you have the Holy of Holies, right? Why would you put the manna in the Ark? Why not put the manna in
the
They could have put it on the. They could have put it on.
Oh, you're saying
they could have put it on the
side.
They could have put right exactly. What's the full?
Because if you study Torah, you'll always have your bread.
Exactly. Exactly. The symbolism is that there is support. If you dedicate yourself, to the Torah, because in that ark, in the Holy of Holies, I mean, you dedicate yourself to Torah the proper way, then your livelihood is going to be provided for you. That's what the man is supposed to symbolize. It's exactly why God wants that man eternally stored. That people should realize that the divine support is going to go with the Torah. Obviously, it has to be done responsibly, so on and so forth. But that people should realize the divine support is going to go with the Torah. Now, when you look at those dimensions of the ark, right? What do those dimensions tell you? Right? They're 2.5 by 1.5 by 1.5. When you read the portion in the Torah that discusses the dimensions of how big the menorah is and how big the table is and how big the altars are, in that section of the Torah, all of the dimensions of all the other equipment in the Beis HaMikdash, the only one with fractional dimensions is the ark. Right? One of the other ones has a couple of fractional dimensions, but the only one where all three dimensions are fractional is the ark. Right? So obviously, what do you think the Torah is trying to communicate? Commentaries say, what does a fraction tell you?
Incompleteness.
Incomplete. Exactly. Stuart, you're on a roll. Right? Incomplete. That you heard this year before, right? The fractional dimensions tell you that there's some type of incompletion. That means that the attitude towards Torah study has to be what? No matter how much you've learned, you can still grow more. Right? There's always more towards, and that's why one of the reasons why Torah is compared to a fig tree. Right, the difference between a fig tree and all other fruit trees is that other fruit trees they reach their harvest at the same time. Right, when you harvest an apple tree, you strip the entire tree. Right, and then you wait for the next season. The fig tree, and I know this is true because A, it's Torah, so that got to be true. B, when I was a little kid, we had a fig tree outside my house. Right, when we used to climb the fig tree. So the same figs that one day, what the Gemara says is when you go to the fig tree. Is every time you go searching, that you'll always find another fig. You just got to look under the right leaf, and you'll find another fig is ripening. That means there's no end to the figs, right? You don't remove them all at once. Torah is the same way. No matter how much Torah you've learned, there's always more depth to the Torah. There's infinite depth to the Torah. There's always something more and something new to be discovered, right? So the person, there's a basic recognition that a person has to recognize that when he studies Torah complete, there's always more Torah to be studied. There's no such thing as having learned the entire Torah, now I'm finished, right? Because once you've learned it, then you got to start forgetting it, right? But even without that, because the Torah is God's quote-unquote, like symbolically and metaphorically, God's mind, therefore it's infinite, as God's mind, as God himself is infinite, therefore there's infinite depth to the Torah. Right? That's the idea of the dimensions of the Torah. Now, something very peculiar about the Torah. When they put the Torah, the Aron Kodesh, in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, right? Let's say this room is the Holy of Holies, which to a certain extent it is, right? Compared to the rest of it, what else is going on at this hour, right? This room is the Holy of Holies. What are you laughing at? Right? I don't mean in the Yeshiva. I mean in general, right? It says in Pirkei Avos, when 10 people sit and study Torah together, what does it say? The Divine Presence rests among them. So the Divine Presence is in this room. Right, whether you agree or not, it is right. Now, if you tell me that you see it, then you really got problems. Right? But the divine presence is there when you study Torah. Right, this is the Holy of Holies, huh?
Just don't put your hand up.
Yeah, right. Let's say this table was your own Kodesh. Now, let's say this is the Holy of Holies. The dimension from that wall to that wall is 20 amos, right? And this is the ark over here, right? If from that wall to that wall would be 20 amos. How far would it be if you measured from that wall to the beginning of the table and from that wall to here? How far would that be? 9 amos, let's say 9 amos, or 8.5 amos, or 7.5, depending on how it was situated, right? According to the Gemara, when you measured from that wall to this part of the ark, 10 amos, right? In spite of the fact that it was 20 amos across the road. From that wall to this part was also 10 amos. What does that mean? That the Aron HaKodesh did not take up any room in the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Something that's completely beyond any type of comprehension for a human being. That something physical, which was physical, can possibly be it's physical but non-physical. Right? It's almost a contradiction in terms. Yet the Aron Kodesh was like that. Now, we'll understand why in a second. What's the mitzvah over here? The mitzvah over here is that they have to carry the Aron Kodesh on their shoulders. Right? The Kohanim are told that they have to carry their Aron Kodesh on their shoulders. How did the Jews get into the land of Israel? When the Jews came after Moshe Rabbeinu died, who led them into the land of Israel?
Joshua.
How did they get, they're coming from the west, they're coming from Jordan, right? They're coming from Jordan to Israel. When you come from Jordan to Israel, the Allenby Bridge, right? The Allenby Bridge wasn't up yet. Exactly. How did they have to get in? How did they cross the Jordan River? So in the Nach, if you look in the third chapter of Yehoshua, I think the third chapter, it says that they came to the Jordan River, and Yehoshua, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu is compared to the sun, and his disciple Yehoshua is compared to the moon. Moshe Rabbeinu split the sea, Yehoshua split the Yarden, right? The Jewish people, there was another splitting. You know, people don't know this, right? There was another splitting. We always talk about the splitting of the Red Sea. The Yarden split also. And this is not a Midrash, in case anybody's skeptical about Midrashim, which you shouldn't be, right? But it's not a Midrash. This is a verse in scriptures, right? In the first book of Yehoshua, it talks about how the Jewish people went, and they entered the Yarden, and when they entered the Yarden split, right? The Kohanim went in there with the Ark, they stood there, the river split, the people went across. Then, based on the verses, the Gemara says there's something peculiar happened. The Ark backed up and went back to the bank where it had come from. Right? It went back to the other side, and the waters closed up. So now you're left with a problem. Those Kohanim are standing on the other side of the Yarden with the Ark, and the people across the Jordan River. Right? Now they're standing where the Ark. Right? How did they get from where they are into the land of Israel? Right? So the Gemara, the Aron, there's something very unique about the Aron Kodesh. The Aron was nose es nose of. The Aron carried those that carried it. What does that mean?
So they just walked in.
The Aron looked like, the people carrying the Aron Kodesh looked like they were actually carrying it. Right? Mm-hmm. But in fact, who was doing the carrying? The Aron was carrying the people. That's why, symbolically, you know, they always use this as a Musar lesson. That the people who are supporting the people who are studying Torah, who's actually supporting whom?
Right.
Giving support to the people who give the money. Right? You say that after you got the money, by the way. Right? You don't tell that before. Don't tell that before you got the money. After you got the money, you say, oh, by the way, I'm doing you a favor by letting you give me money. Right? Well, okay, great. I don't need any of your favors. But in the ultimate reality is that that's what's happening, that we're giving the support to the people who are carrying us. Now, they were carried across. They have to get across the Yarden with the Aron. Right? So how did they get across the Yarden? So the answer is that the Aron Kodesh, you know, there are two types of miracles. And when you think of a miracle, there are two types of miracles. What's the ultimate miracle you think of?
The Red Sea.
Splitting of the sea. Name a miracle. Splitting of the sea. By the way, the bad news is that the Gemara says that it is difficult for God to match people up as splitting the sea. Right? That means every time a couple makes a commitment to each other, a couple gets married, that's considered splitting the sea. Right? Just keep that in mind. Right? That is no less a miracle. There's no less a miracle. The Gemara says that there was a Roman, some Roman lady asked one of the sages, what's God been doing since he created the world, now what's he been doing? Right? So he said to her, he's been matchmaking. Right, he's been mizavik zivugim, it's matching people up. She said, that's not so tough. So she called in a whole bunch of her slaves, and she lined them up. She said, you're going to marry you, you're going to marry him, you're going to marry him. Right? She matched them up and told them to go get married. Right? They came back the next day. This one was bruised, this one had a broken arm, this one had a broken foot. Yeah, well, what's the problem? I can't stand him, I can't stand her. They couldn't stand each other. She came there, she said, well, I see, it's much more difficult. You remember when the Moonies did that, about maybe 10, 15 years ago, where the Reverend Sun Young Moon took about 5,000 of his followers, and he had a mass wedding for about 5,000 of his followers. Remember that? He matched them up, right? I don't know. We don't have any statistics about how those wet marriages went, right? But that's what this Midrash always reminded me of. The point is that when you think of a miracle, the basic miracle is splitting the sea. Now, what happens when you split the sea? It's a pretty fundamental idea. When you split the sea, what happens to nature?
That's
a miracle. Nature stops performing the way it's supposed to perform. That means not only it stops performing, nature is set aside in the face of the miracle. You got to get through the sea. Nature is pushed aside, so to speak, and you walk through the sea. You got to get through the Yarden. What do? Nature is set aside. You walk through the Yarden. That's one type of miracle. What about the miracle of the Aron Kodesh in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, where the Aron Kodesh does not take up any space? There, you're not pushing nature aside. You're not pushing. Nature is unaffected by that. Right? Nothing is affected for this miracle to happen. Here's the difference between the two. Subtle difference. One type of miracle is that there's some change in nature. There's another miracle where there's no change. Moshe Rabbeinu went up to get the Torah. How long was he up on the mountain for? 40 days and 40 nights. What did he eat?
Nothing.
Right? He didn't eat food. That's certainly a miracle. Was anything in nature set aside to perform that miracle? No. Nothing in nature had to be pushed aside for that miracle to happen.